Hello. Welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first article that I would like to read for you today is from the Wall Street Journal, the 8th of August. The title of this article is Jobs Shrink in New Test for Economy, and the article was written for the journal by Matt Grossman. The United States labor market shed jobs in July, an unexpected contraction likely to renew questions about the economy's fundamental strength at a time when it is facing elevated inflation. The Labor Department's July jobs report showed that the economy lost 23,000 jobs last month, a big shortfall versus the gain of 83,000 that economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal had expected. Revisions to May and June payrolls numbers showed that the economy added 103,000 fewer jobs in those 2 months. The soft jobs market prompted investors to scale back expectations for an interest rate increase by the Federal Reserve at its next meeting. The Standard & Poor's 500 rose 0.6% to a record on Friday, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 151 points, or 0.3%. The NASDAQ Composite climbed 1.3%. And Treasury yields edged lower on Friday. More Americans stepped back from the labor market entirely, according to the Labor Department's monthly survey of households. As a result, the unemployment rate eased to 4.1% from 4.2% in June, even though fewer people were even working. The sizable pullback in hiring marked a shift for a labor market that appeared on the upswing earlier this year. Elevated inflation is likely to remain the Federal Reserve's primary concern, however. Government job losses pulled July's number into negative territory, but private sector hiring made a weak showing as well. Overall, private employers added 30,000 jobs. In a bright spot, likely reflecting the boom in data centers, the construction sector added 22,000 jobs last month. Manufacturing gained 5,000, but leisure and hospitality employers cut 40,000 workers after cutting even more in June, while retailers shed more than 19,000 employees. Private sector education and healthcare jobs grew by 25,000, a relatively poor result for what has been a big source of new jobs over the past year. Though unemployment remains low, economists who were expecting stronger July hiring saw little to cheer about in the latest jobs figures. The July employment report was flat out weak. Chris Lowe, who is chief economist at FHN Financial, wrote in a note to clients. Eric Winograd, an economist at AllianceBernstein, said statistical noise likely pulled down government jobs totals and might explain some of July's weaknesses, but the big downward revisions pointed to broader concerns. July is a month with massive seasonal adjustments, but you cannot explain away the downward revisions to May and June quite as well, Winograd said. Over the past 2 months, the labor force fell by nearly a million workers, a large decline for which economists have not yet pinned down a clear cause. Faster retirements or the Trump administration's immigration crackdown are natural suspects here, but many analysts don't think those factors are the full story. The trend has pulled down the unemployment rate because it means fewer people are even competing for limited available jobs. It is a mixed blessing at best because a smaller workforce limits how much the economy can grow. The July report and downward revisions left the job market looking suddenly shakier and could give the Fed officials pause before guessing forward was the September rate increase, some were considering. The numbers paint an ambiguous picture for the central bank. It aims for lower unemployment, but last month unemployment fell for the wrong reasons. Elevated inflation is likely to remain the Fed's main focus for now. It led three officials to dissent in favor of a rate increase at the Fed's meeting last month, and others more recently suggested a rate increase could be the best next move. On Friday, traders slightly pared back their bets that the Fed will raise rates next month. Before that meeting, the Fed is going to get plenty of additional data to consider, including another month of job market numbers and July and August inflation statistics. Kevin Warsh, who is the Fed's chairman since May, has said little about his read of the labor market, in keeping with his philosophy that investors should form their own judgments about economic fundamentals. Before Friday's data, though, other officials argued that a sounder job market should make the Fed comfortable with raising rates if needed. Next week's inflation report is going to be quite important for the Fed, said Satyam Fande, who is chief U.S. economist at S&P Global Ratings. Friday's report also marked the second straight year that the July numbers included substantial negative revisions to previous month's data. When the July 2025 data were published, the May and June totals that year were revised down by a combined 285,000, leading President Trump to fire the commissioner of the Labor Department Statistics Agency, Erica McEntefar, hours later. Monthly jobs revisions are a routine but a frustrating reality for economists. They are necessary because many of the roughly 125,000 employers surveyed monthly about staffing totals send in their responses late, if they do at all. A second straight year with big negative summertime revisions could send economists searching for a deeper statistical explanation for that pattern. Even before Friday, though, Americans were saying that they were unsettled about the labor market. Subdued hiring and layoffs left many feeling stuck. In recent months, more than a quarter of the unemployed have been looking for work for more than 6 months. That number declined in July, which can sometimes mean that people stuck in long, frustrating job searches have even given up altogether. In a July consumer survey from the Conference Board, a research group, 24.6% said jobs seem plentiful, while 21.5% said they are hard to get, the least favorable split since 2021. The next article today also appeared in the August 8th issue of the Wall Street Journal and is related to the previous article. This one is entitled, Fewer Workers Keep Unemployment Low. This article was written for the journal by Justin Lehart. This week's anemic employment report rekindled a burning question for the U.S. economy. How many new jobs does it actually need? The Labor Department on Friday reported that the U.S. had shed 23,000 jobs in May and also lowered its May and June figures. With that, the data now show the economy added 44,000 jobs a month over the past 6 months. That isn't quite as weak as the back half of last year, but it is a far cry from what people used to think of as healthy. And yet the unemployment rate has fallen to 4.1% from 4.4% this year. That is an indication that the United States might not need to generate that many jobs to keep up with a dwindling supply of new workers. The youngest of the baby boomers are turning 62 this year, eligible for their Social Security retirement benefits, while there is a low supply of younger United States-born workers to take their place. Meanwhile, President Trump's immigration crackdown has limited the supply of foreign-born people entering the workforce. Some economists expect more of the same in the months ahead. My guess would be that the rest of the year will, if anything, see slower jobs growth than what we've been seeing so far, said the American Enterprise Institute's Dan Venger. In joint work with Brookings Institution economists Wendy Edelberg and Tara Watson, Venger estimated that the economy only needs to add about 15,000 jobs each month to keep the unemployment rate steady. Some aspects of Friday's report suggested that immigration restrictions are having an effect. Labor force participation, the share of people either working or actively seeking work, has weakened across a broad range of age groups. That is consistent with the immigration headwinds narrative, wrote Barclays Economist on Friday. Moreover, the unemployment rate among the foreign-born population slipped to 3.2%, adjusting for seasonal swings, from 4% in January, according to Haver Analytics. That could be because those foreign-born workers who are engaged in the labor market, for example, those with green cards, are having an easier time finding a job. Construction, which employs a lot of immigrant workers, added 22,000 jobs last month, with gains concentrated in the specialty trade contracting work that continues to benefit from the artificial intelligence build-out. But leisure and hospitality, also highly immigrant-dependent, shed 40,000 jobs. To an extent, a smaller supply of potential workers suggests that the labor market can be considered healthy, even if there aren't quite as many jobs getting created as in the past. That is one message from the low employment rate. For the overall U.S. economy, it could be more of a mixed bag. That is because the economy relies on two big engines in the labor market, growth in the workforce and growth in how much workers get done, or productivity. The aging population and the workforce the U.S. will need to support them creates particular urgency. There are now about 66 million people living in the U.S. who are 65 or older, according to Congressional Budget Office estimates. In 10 years, the CBO projects that will increase to 78 million. Artificial intelligence could help. One of the few things economists generally agree on about the new technology is that it will boost productivity. But they also generally think those productivity increases are not showing up broadly thus far. Few workers are using AI intensively, and while the Labor Department has registered a productivity pickup in recent years, Barclays economists argue that this is probably just an artifact of the whipsawing of the labor market following the COVID-19 shock. Even though AI investment has been occurring at a breakneck pace, it does take time for workers and businesses to adapt to a new technology. You cannot just hand somebody a nail gun and expect them to know how to use it. That could mean that for the next few years at least, the economy might not be able to grow very quickly, or at least not without the unemployment rate going even lower, with the risk that a tightening labor market starts pushing inflation higher. The alternative here might be for the U.S. to expand its labor pool. Japan, for example, has struggled with its aging population, but it has succeeded in bringing more women into the workforce. The share of women ages 25 to 54 in Japan working or actively seeking work has lately been 86% versus about 67% back in the year 2000. In the U.S., labor force participation for women ages 25 to 54 went from a bit less than 77% in 2000 to 77.8% as of July. The next article that I would like to read for you today is taken from the Wall Street Journal, the 15th of June. This article was written for the journal by Tara Weiss, and the title is More Employees Embrace Micro Shifting, Carving Their Workday into Chunks. The hope is that it can help people produce better work while preventing burnout and turnover. After working traditional hours for more than 20 years, John D. Connolly realized that wasn't how he worked the best. I'd be dialed in, looking at the computer for 6 hours, but I wouldn't have any more gas in me, says Connolly, who is 46. I'd have to sit there for another 2.5 hours. Connolly, founder of financial services advisory firm Bifrost Advisors, works at home before his toddler wakes up, takes a break to have breakfast with the family, and works about 4 hours before lunch with his wife. He resumes work around 4 in the afternoon and continues until dinner, often returning to finish things up after his son is in bed. He puts in work on the weekends when necessary. He is among the workers who have embraced micro-shifting, or carving their day into short chunks of work, with intentional breaks for family time or personal replenishment. While employees who work from home have long squeezed personal business into their workday, with or without the boss's blessing, more are now openly working at the times when they are the most productive, often in segments of several hours, and some companies are encouraging it. Indeed, Connolly began working in micro shifts at his previous job, at Woozle Research, where he was head of marketing. His former boss at that company, a research platform serving institutional investors, encouraged employees to work at the times that were best for them. Instead of forcing everybody into a rigid schedule, we focus on output and deliverables, says Woozle founder Mark Pasiti, who is based in Glasgow, Scotland, and works in 2-hour micro shifts himself. If someone does their best deep research work in a focused 5-hour window, that's more valuable to us and our clients than 8 hours of diminishing returns. COVID's work-from-home requirement demonstrated that employees can work successfully from anywhere without a boss watching over them all of the time. And now flexibility increasingly means giving employees more control over when they work, not just where, which has made micro-shifting a buzzy work style, particularly in outcome-oriented businesses where results are more important than time spent at a desk. While there is little data out there on micro-shifting, it is more likely to be prevalent in industries where flexible work arrangements already are common, such as IT, financial services, and professional and technical services, says Anita Williams Woolley, who is Associate Dean of Research and Professor of Organizational Behavior at Carnegie Mellon University. People who have caregiving responsibilities at home for children or for other relatives are more likely to try micro shifting than are non-caregivers, according to a recent report on the state of hybrid work from Owl Labs, a company that sells video conferencing technology. The report found that 78% of caregivers are interested in micro-shifting, compared with only 28% of non-caregivers. Artificial intelligence scheduling programs that enable even in-person service employees, such as those who work at restaurants or retailers, to schedule several shorter shifts in a day are likely helping to drive the trend, says Williams Woolley. For example, restaurant workers might schedule shifts in between when they have to drop off and pick up their children from school, and then use the AI scheduler to find chunks of time afterward when they are available to work and the restaurant needs staff. Accommodating the changing needs and preferences of employees in a high turnover industry is a complex optimization problem that has been challenging even for sophisticated software to solve, says Williams Woolley. Artificial intelligence also has helped to accelerate the microshift movement by taking over lower-level tasks that keep people chained to their desks during specific hours, such as sorting and responding to emails. That frees up people for higher-level work, the kind that requires more concentration and can be done when the employees know that they can be most productive. If done correctly, micro-shifting prevents burnout. When you're trying to solve really difficult problems, you can only push for so long, said Williams Woolsey. Whitney Monroe, who is founder of a boutique consulting firm, has long known that when she works in 3 to 4 hour chunks with intentional breaks designed to incorporate movement and household chores, she produces her best work. Monroe starts each workday with a priority check, noting the 3 most important things she must accomplish for work by 10 a.m. She works without interruption by marking her calendar as busy until about 10:30 a.m. Even email waits until that period is up. If anything urgent does arise, an AI tool flags it and sends a notification to her phone. Then she breaks to take the dogs for a walk. The next few hours are for emailing, connecting with clients and coworkers, and making phone calls until about 2 p.m. when my brain stops. She eats lunch then, throws in a load of laundry, and prepares dinner. She returns to work for a few hours in the late afternoon or the early evening. If I push too hard, I get overwhelmed and pressure sets in, says Monroe. And when that happens, she takes a break or she pushes her most important to-do items to the next morning to ensure that she is doing her best work. Of course, micro-shifting comes with pitfalls. Without structure and proper planning, employees could fall behind on deadlines and actually wind up working round the clock. Team members, meanwhile, need to be aware of their colleagues' preferred work hours and when they are available to respond to emails and questions. You can't just have a whole group of individuals doing their own thing, said Callie Williams-Yost, founder and CEO of Flex Strategy Group, a firm that helps employers design flexible work options. Without clarity, we have an infinite workday. Practitioners also say that it takes extreme discipline to focus intensely for those short periods. Monroe, for example, avoids looking at or responding to emails when she is doing deep, high-level work. Simple adjustments such as auto-scheduling when client emails are sent can help. When she started her consulting firm from her suburban Dallas area home in 2022, Monroe specifically looked for employees who wanted to micro-shift. New employees complete a questionnaire that asks how they work best, including their time zone, their peak work hours, and what times of day they are most distracted. Knowing each team member's optimal work time helps everybody plan deadlines and communication. Our clients don't ask, "Are you working on my project from 8 to 5?" says Monroe, who manages a team of 5 full-time employees and about 22 freelancers scattered across the country. They care about the product and if it comes in on deadline. Similarly, Pasiti says that when he founded Woozle Research 10 years ago, his goal at the time was to work smarter, not harder. Much of the work his researchers do is measurable since it involves making a certain number of cold calls by an established deadline. To improve efficiency, the firm invested in productivity tracking tools to determine when employees were most productive and when that productivity stopped or dropped. The management team learned that the last 3 to 4 hours of an 8-hour shift were much less productive than the earlier hours, And so the management team implemented shorter shifts and found employees completed more surveys per hour. As technology improved, particularly AI, that handles time-consuming administrative tasks such as building spreadsheets or sorting out important from low-priority emails, Pasiti evangelized working in micro-shifts to his staff and promoted it in recruiting. Burnout in his industry is prevalent, so Pasiti markets flexibility as a recruitment tool in an industry not known for it. Says Pasiti, this is not only what people want, but what works best. Next up is six jobs from the 1950s that barely exist today, but this is related to careers. This is from an article entitled History Facts, and it comes from the internet. This was written for the internet by Christina Wright. The American workforce has transformed dramatically since the 1950s, a decade marked by economic prosperity, suburban expansion, and rapid industrialization. It is likely that folks at the time could not have imagined how much the U.S. job market would change over the next few decades, or how quickly innovation would make once common jobs almost obsolete. Careers such as switchboard operator and typist may have seemed stable and essential in the mid-20th century, but time, technology, and changing needs have made them and many others all but disappear. Some occupations that once played a vital role in the daily lives of many Americans still do exist in niche markets, but they're a far cry from their heyday. Here are some jobs that were popular back in the 1950s, but now are nearly extinct. First, the milkman. Having fresh milk delivered to your doorstep was once a common part of American life. The local milkman made daily or weekly rounds, leaving glass bottles on doorsteps and retrieving empty ones. This service was necessary before the widespread adoption of home refrigeration, as fresh dairy products spoiled quickly. In the 50s, more than half of consumer milk sales came from home delivery services. However, the rise of supermarkets and improved refrigeration technology made milk delivery nearly obsolete. By 1975, home-delivered milk accounted for only about 7% of total milk sales. And by 2005, this number had dwindled to just 0.4%. While some niche companies still offer home deliveries today, the classic image of a uniformed milkman carrying a metal crate is now obsolete. This does bring us to the end of the time that we have for our program on careers today. I hope you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.